I imagine. You all might have heard Suzuki Roshi's classic saying, "You're perfect as you are, and you could use some improvement." I think it's a beautiful Dharma statement. One of those Zen spontaneous utterances that he probably didn't think much about at the time, but then get passed around the Dharma world. My teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, I think their mission statement of their organization uses this Suzuki Roshi quote. Somehow. So there's these two sides. And as I consider this and I hear, it was wonderful to hear people's thoughts, which may be already different by the afternoon, which we expressed this morning about our current take on what is awakening and what is our vow in regards to it. And then we have this record that comes to us that has a certain style, and I think how different, actually, seems to me how different the style of this record is compared to our own expressions. One might say, well, really, we can see how they're quite similar. But contemplating this, I think, well, I think it's good to acknowledge like the bigger factors here. We've talked about it a little bit maybe this week, cultural factors. And having practiced Zen in both Japan and America, I feel like there's differences, and also ancient and modern times. At the risk of making broad, sweeping generalizations, I would say maybe American Zen emphasizes more the perfect as you are side, and I think a term that came up maybe with several of us this morning was acceptance, self-acceptance. I think this is really big in American Zen circles. And it might not be mentioned ever in Keizan's record, at least in those words, maybe implications of it. Maybe Dogen, a little more implications, but as a kind of practice, and maybe the other side of like, you could use some improvement, particularly in Keizan, I think more than Dogen. There's something to get, and you better work hard to get it. It's woven through almost every one of these stories. And it's a context. And I think part of the Asian and American difference is a cultural thing. My teacher, Sogni Rinpoche, says he, who has many American and Asian students, and it feels like they're actually really are different generally. That the Americans and Europeans tend to have like lower self-esteem and tend to maybe not like themselves so much, whereas the Asians don't really have that issue in general. Again, broad generalization. And therefore, they're more. This maybe comes from who knows all the conditions, Puritan ethics of our forefathers, strong values towards capitalism. Maybe actually promotes working harder, you'll fall behind, and. Who knows all the conditions, but I think maybe there's something to it. So he's soaking in, but he says when he's teaching the Asians, he has to really like kind of kick him in the butt. Say, you gotta really like focus here and practice more intensively. And with his American students, he says, you gotta relax more and really like our lifestyle is so stressed. And that's maybe connected too. With this kind of self-judgment, maybe related to the fast-paced, modern, techno-stress society. And we can remember this when we hear Keizan speaking to the small group of probably mostly young male monks in the 13th, 14th century Japan. Also, many of them were coming from what was called the Darumashu. You maybe know some of this history. It was a kind of a, they say, antinomian, a kind of a renegade Zen movement in this time in Japan of like, maybe we talked about Buji Zen, kind of like, again, coming from this ultimate perspective. Everything's perfect, so there's nothing to do. And so, like, things like precepts and stuff we don't really need, and even meditation, you know, this is it. And Dogen, many of Dogen's students came to him from this Daruma school, the Bodhidharma school. And also they were like, didn't have a lineage, they kind of made themselves up. And then many of that, they still continued to practice with Ejo and actually Tetsu Gikai, Keizan's teacher, came from this Daruma Shu. So this is also part of the context of, we might say they were very self-accepting. They were perfect as they were, and Dogen thought they could use some improvement. So all this is historical context. And as we talked about this morning, Kathy brought up, I really see the careful kind of skillful means of Ru Jing talking to his particular student, Dogen. Dogen was looking for the secret essence of practice, and Ru Jing just gave him some really straightforward teachings, like out of the Pali Canon. And so context, again, and means. So if we're in American society where American Zen, maybe we need more of the self-acceptance, but maybe that becomes our main teaching. And also parenthetically, again, as a broad generalization, this may be also related to the feminization of American Zen. It's probably about half and half men and women in American Zen, whereas the Japanese Zen is very male dominated. So this kind of, a mother, this kind of classic archetypes, mother's very accepting of her child and the father's strict. And sometimes could be reversed, but as stereotypes, we have these gender differences. Also, does anyone know David Deida? He's a, I think, brilliant spiritual teacher with Buddhist background, but mainly talks about the realm of like male-female relationships and how to really like harmonize these in a way that really works. And I think he's really has some insight into some of these differences. And again, even he will say these roles can completely switch, but this kind of like, you might call it the masculine, which doesn't necessarily mean male or female, but the masculine kind of essence, he would say is like the highest desire, or something like that. Maybe the deepest yearning and desire for the masculine essence is towards transcendence and emptiness and completely, even maybe disappearing completely. In some kind of archetypal way that, you know, even if people don't have any practice, and whereas the feminine essence is more towards like creative expression and tangible like being in the world as the highest yearning of spiritual yearning even. and that they're both totally necessary and they're both beautiful sides of practice. We could even say these are the two truths. One form of talking about form and emptiness, or the conventional, or the world of activity and appearance, and the world of when nothing's happening. And they're not separate ever either. And it's not like one is better than the other. They're both equally valid and true. So David Deida, I think, expounds this more fully and clearly than I could. But when I hear that, I personally resonate. I feel like I think I have a strong masculine essence. If I'm not in a relationship with a woman with a somewhat strong feminine essence, I tend to get unbalanced, actually. So I feel like a lot of what Kazon's coming from is this transcendent emptiness, breaking through, dropping off, non-doing side of things. But he's the mother, yeah, right. He's the mother. Yeah, so maybe we can't map these things perfectly. I haven't thought like... if American Zen is maybe emphasizing self-acceptance, I think Kazon Zen, at least I see a lot woven through here, is emphasizing shame, promoting shame. Maybe this particular round of talks, he hasn't come up, but Kazon himself says, I feel so ashamed of my practice when I hear about these ancestors. And we probably all should. And it's the age of decline, and we can never practice the true way like they did in the old days. There's a lot of that feeling as a kind of like a practice means, I think, that Kazon brings out for that assembly. That again, maybe as they're Asians, they have the self-acceptance side down. So if they have that down, then maybe they need to hear the side of some improvement. So I hear like shame, emphasis on shame, renunciation, striving, reaching what must be reached, following the footsteps of the ancestors, and so on. So we have to be careful. And I thought, well, since when we went around, I hear a lot of the side of just being the self-acceptance side. I thought, well, maybe Kazon's the perfect medicine for American Zen if we're already grounded in that side. Like now, let's leap forward from there. If, on the other hand, that's our practice of self-acceptance because we actually have a really hard time with it, and we actually really don't like ourselves, then in a strong way, really like, I hate myself, you know, maybe we should leave the room for Kazon's talks. Yeah.
Because in the acceptance that I heard, I did hear a little about self-acceptance, but more, I heard it a little bit differently, more like the kind of acceptance that says, that's like the faith in mind acceptance. This is how it is now, and I'm meeting it
As opposed to...
or unpleasant. It's just like, I'm just here. I'm not trying to squeeze it all onto the side of pleasant.
Mm-hmm. So maybe in that way, acceptance as a kind of renunciation, actually.
Absolutely.
Because, I think they are similar. Or letting go is a definition of renunciation.
At least for me, that's connected to that is kind of self-compassion for, you know, the one who wants it not to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So... willing for it to be painful.
Yeah.
It is in that moment. And then also, you know, the motherly side of this compassionate embrace, kind of this loving kindness toward the one.
Yeah. You could say wisdom and compassion are, in a way, the wisdom side, the emptiness side, and its full culmination maybe is the complete letting go. And then the compassion side is, and let's really not be too hard on the one that can't let go, because that actually prevents letting go. Yes?
I used to read a lot of Pema Chodron when I was really suffering a lot. And she always seemed to speak to that. But she uses the word refraining instead of renunciation.
Mm.
It's a slightly different flavor.
Yeah.
Like it's a choice instead of kind of beating yourself over the head. And refraining from that thing in kind of... constantly sort of letting go of it, and feeling the pain of that, you know, of you wanting it, but you're letting it go, you want it, but you kind of let it go, you want it, but you let it go. She talks about it's the heart opening, it softens the heart, and that's where compassion comes from.
Yeah.
So that it basically leads to compassion. Kind of.
For others, actually.
Yes, well, for yourself.
Well, it sounds like,
it's kind of like
your self-compassion leads to compassion for others.
Because other people may have other desires that are, you know, more toxic, like drugs or something like that. And, you know, maybe we're just, like, wanting some ice cream or extra ice cream. I mean, something that's fairly, you know, low-level harmful. But it's that same kind of craving and kind of seeing that activity in yourself.
It's the human condition.
Yeah, the human condition, exactly. So it isn't just the... it seemed like that's kind of the piece that's kind of like that is that thing I have to repeat kind of over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of just do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is some transformation available in that.
Mm-hmm.
That it does kind of soften and open the heart, and I think that can be the transforming.
Yeah.
It can be a transforming kind of piece of
practice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think it must be. Mm-hmm. And this how, you know, how the response comes in a different situations. And maybe if we're feeling even the extreme of like very self-confident, like maybe Dogen was, and like this is like everything's completely perfect side, we might feel like, well, how are they ever there? But then maybe that's the time, then the strict teaching comes. Mm-hmm. So I just think of also people coming to see me in Dokusan or to bring up their practice, and quite often actually people say everything's going pretty well. People like to report how things are going well. No problem really. Maybe I'll try to think of something, but actually it's, and then I usually feel like, well, it's a waste of time if I just say, oh, great. So I say, well, how about work on this, and what about this? And I, you know, sometimes I'll go there. Whereas if someone comes like really expressing a lot of pain and they're really having difficulty with these, I'm not going to say you should be more like strict with yourself, you know. So for whatever reasons, I think often seem to come to me, this is again a sweeping generalization, with like everything's going well. And so then maybe if I get too much of that, I'm like, we need some K's on around here. Yes.
Well, I mean, I sort of like the enlightened people of today are exactly the same. And admittedly, that was an Asian person in the, 12, Lingyao was 1200, speaking to other Asians, so it might not quite be chanted to Divi, so it must, you know, have some value.
Yeah, there must be. we could say, if there's any enlightened people today, then by definition, that's the same enlightenment as those of old. But he's not saying everyone today is enlightened like the ancients, right? Just that we might say, well, in today's enlightenment is just, you know, every generation it loses a little light. Dogen's saying, but that's ridiculous. But, yeah, it's dimming and dimming. And maybe that would be one version of the age of decline, that the doctrine of the age of decline is the time of the semblance dharma, they say, where it looks like the true dharma, like there's people practicing Buddhism, it looks like, but it's actually, there's no real dharma there. I think that's one description of that. Yeah, I think of like, and then we all have our karmic dispositions, you know. High standards for enlightenment, and if they get too high, everyone gets depressed and leaves, and no one wants to practice. There are such places where nobody comes, the standard's too high. Then I think the skillful means is not working. And then if the standard's too low, lots of people like to be enlightened. or be praised as enlightened, so but then something else is lost. This has always been the case, I think. Maybe not just Buddhism, but everywhere. So Dogen, I think, had really high standards and he had a small community. And here's a little more of his story. So remember, we left off where Dogen wrote this letter to Ru Jing and said, I just want to practice with, be able to come and ask you questions day and night. And Ru Jing said, okay, you can. Formally or informally. After that, Dogen studied the inner truth day and night and received the truth directly from Ru Jing. Once Dogen was asked to be his jisha, his attendant, Dogen declined, saying, being a foreigner from Japan, if I were to become your attendant in this great monastery, in this great land, it might cause criticism or jealousy in the monastery. Some of you might think, I can't believe an Australian is the attendant.
Who does he think he is?
Does anyone else want the joke?
So maybe it's a little commentary on there's kind of some like, you know, racial or national prejudice going on in Dogen's time, as there always is and probably will be. Anyway, Dogen kind of picked up on that, whether it was true or not. And he said, it might cause some issue. Also, maybe like, I just got here. I think he was only there total for like 2 years, I think. So he's like, maybe somebody more senior should be the attendant. I only wish to visit you day and night, Dogen said. Ru Jing said, truly what you say is modest and reasonable. So I'll agree to your request to not be the attendant. Consequently, Dogen just had dialogues with Ru Jing and received instructions. Then is the story of hearing about dropping body and mind during night zazen and dropping body and mind. From about the time that Dogen met Ru Jing, he practiced away day and night, never ceasing or veering off for a moment. He never lay down to sleep. Priest Ru Jing would tell him, you conduct yourself like the ancient Buddhas. You will doubtlessly spread the way of the ancestors. My finding you is like the venerable Shakyamuni finding Mahakashyapa. So in 1225, Dogen became an ancestor in the 51st generation. Lu Jing instructed him, saying, "Return to your own country at once and spread the ancestral way. Seclude yourself deep in the mountains and mature what you have attained." Or the Japanese expression is, mature the sacred womb. And you hear this in other Zen stories too. And I don't know where this comes from. It sounds almost kind of Taoist. But I think the implication is that it's something about awakening, actually, that you have some insight, but it takes a long time to mature the insight and have it pervade your daily life. So this is the sacred womb of your understanding, and now you have to take care of this gestating awakening for a long time as it grows before it's fully born into the world. Sometimes they say, and they also say, nurture this sacred womb for some years before you go out and start teaching deep in the mountains. And then there's about like two pages here all about Dogen's seeing these documents of succession of all these different Chinese ancestors, and you can read about it. Actually, it's all just pretty much quoted from Shobo Genzo Shisho. Shisho is the transmission succession document. And Dogen was like really into this stuff. And it wasn't his own documents, it was other people's, and they're kind of private. So there's all these stories about, have you ever seen one of these? And Dogen's like, no, but I'd love to. And well, since I have some good feeling about our connection, let me show you. This is a Yunmen lineage document, or a Linji. And Dogen talks about all the details of them and how they differ and are the same. So for some reason, Kazan just put like pages of that thing in there. And maybe, I don't know why, but maybe it's because this whole record in a way is kind of like trying to establish this new lineage in a new country. And so it's like these documents are about the authenticity of the lineage.
Yeah. It just seems like the whole book's sort of a bit like that, you know. Dogen sort of came up with all the instructions and he said it. Now what else do we need? We need some tradition, we need some good stories.
Yeah. In fact, the Zen lineage was maybe first appeared in the world at the time of the sixth ancestor. Huineng, the sixth ancestor himself, says the teaching came from Shakyamuni Buddha, and he lists all those ancestors we chant up to his teacher. And from then on, then it became historical and established. So it was happening, and the stories were around, but in the introduction, the translator says, that was part of what was going on here with Kazan's talks, is he's trying to establish legitimacy. And also, you know, they always say about the ancestors' birth have some relation to some previous emperor. So I think genealogy and noble birth was really important concept in Asia in general, especially China. And so some people say, and Confucianism was really into family lineage. So they say this whole thing about Zen lineage was not there in Indian Buddhism, and it was kind of a Confucian Chinese value that was very strong. So they brought that in to Zen. So I'm going to skip that whole part about the documents of succession. Having received recognition by various teachers, having received the seal of approval of Ru Jing, having resolved the great matter of his life, and having received the Dharma instruction of successive ancestors, Dogen returned to Japan in 1227. First he settled at Kenin Monastery, where the remains of his original teacher Eisai were, and trained for a while. He was 27 years old. So, and there's stories about how this is where he used to practice. This is Rinzai Monastery. He felt like Eisai was this great noble teacher who had died, and while Dogen was gone in China, he felt like the practice of Keninji was degrading and kind of falling apart. But he did stay there for a couple of years, but you feel like I gotta actually get out of here and find a new place. And actually, that's not in here, but in one of the other versions of the biography, his later-to-be student, Kōen Ejo, came to hear about Dogen's teaching and practice with him. He said, actually, I'm sorry, but the conditions are not here for... You really can't be my student here, because it's this other monastery, and it's a different style, and I'll let you know when I have a different place. I thought that was interesting. The movie, the Dogen movie, portrays this quite well, I think. Dogen's coming back to Keninji and practicing really sincerely with those around him, were involved in various shenanigans. Later, while seeking a scenic place that would be a secluded retreat, he inspected 13 places offered by patrons in the Osaka-Kyoto region. And I had to wonder, did he have 13 patrons on the first year that he returned as a 27-year-old from China? How did this happen? Was offering him land for a monastery, but he turned them all down. It's not quite the right place. He was kind of picky. None of these met his expectations. For a while, he stayed near Gokuraku Temple in Fukakusa in the Uji district of Kyoto. He was 34 by now. Monks seeking the teaching gathered gradually, and eventually there were more than 50. So there were more than 50 practice with Dogen, at least in Koshoji near Kyoto, before he moved to the mountains. And it sounds like the lengthier history is that it was an abandoned temple that he just called Anyoin, that was part of another temple, maybe a building that they weren't using, and like a hermitage. And Dogen apparently just lived there, and he said nobody came for 2 years. He just practiced completely alone at this time in his life. I thought it was quite interesting. And then that same place, as people started coming, they rebuilt the abandoned temple as Koshoji, where he stayed for 10 years before moving to Eheiji. 10 years later, he moved to Echizen and opened a monastery in the Shibi family villa. This was when his main patron was a shogun. He got rid of the brambles, rethatching it, repairing it with wood and clay, and teaching the ancestral way. This is the present Eheiji. Then Keizan now tells this story about Buddha Dharma coming to Japan first in 552 with some like Buddha paintings and statues. Maybe that's how it comes to America first, is the Buddhist art. Cool. And then, well, what's that coming from? What's that about? And then Prince Shotoku, really like in 587, 30 years later, was the first like Buddhist emperor in Japan and actually taught the Lotus Sutra and so on. And so it's this history to say that the true Dharma, according to Keizan, didn't arrive until Dogen came on the scene 700 years, almost 700 years after Buddha Dharma first came to Japan. We'll skip that part. Although Dogen thoroughly grasped the Rinzai style and was a true descendant of Eisai, he still called on priest Ru Jing. I thought it's nice too, because he had practiced many years, both in the Tendai school and the Rinzai Zen school with Eisai, and he was a Dharma successor of Eisai, but he still went off to China to learn more. he was not easily satisfied with his understanding. And he returned to Japan to spread the Dharma. This was truly good fortune for our nation and a blessing for the people. It was like Bodhidharma coming from India to China as the first ancestor, Dogen being the first ancestor in Japan. and so on. Moreover, I, Keizan, have been fortunate to gratefully seek out the ancestral style as the fourth generation follower of this Soto approach. It is like the Chinese third ancestor meeting the fourth ancestor. He's kind of saying, in this new country, it's like these few generations after it begins and kind of like reminiscing of the old ones. And now we are like the third and fourth generations of Zen ancestors in this country after Suzuki Roshi as the founding teacher. So we're kind of like the same period in a way of a new country. The teaching style has not collapsed. Although there are different traces in India, China, and Japan, what they transmit has not changed a bit. How could the essential point that utterly pervades the Dharma be anything else? You must first clarify mind, with a capital M here, which is be of significance in a minute. In the situation where Dogen first realized the way, it was said that practicing Zen is dropping off body and mind. Truly, the practice of Zen consists of abandoning the body and leaving mind behind. That's what the translator put in for your relaxation. Consists of abandoning, in parentheses, attachment to the body and leaving, in parentheses, ordinary mind behind. If body and mind have not been dropped off, it is not the way. You may think that the body is skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, but when you see thoroughly, not a hair's tip of them can be found. A bit like talked about the other day. What is the body actually in our direct experience, apart from what we've heard many times that it's made of skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, but actually, that's our direct experience is not skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Yeah, the direct experience is like sensation, energy, contact of sense faculty and object. So we could say, if we see thoroughly, not a hair's tip, not an atom of skin, flesh, bones, and marrow can actually be found in our direct experience besides just the idea. Well, this is skin, right? People think that, so that's the commentary on body. Dropping off body is not being able to find a hair's tip of skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. People think there are two kinds of mind. One is mind as thought and discrimination, and this consciousness which discriminates external events. The second is the mind that is still and unmoving and does not know or understand anything, the mind of purity and stillness. People do not understand that such a mind is still not exempt from being the root of discriminating consciousness. The ancients referred to it as the place of deep inner clarity or brightness that is unmoved. Do not mistake this for mind, capital M, and abide there. So this is now Keizan's commentary on dropping off body and mind, which I think is very beautiful and quite subtle compared to Rujing. So ancestors can express this in different ways. So he's saying that we're dropping off the discriminating thinking mind, which is not to be believed as some true mind. And he's saying there's this other still and unmoving mind that doesn't understand anything. And he's saying, but actually, this one we have to drop off also, because this is the root of the discriminating consciousness. And what came to mind for me here is, sometimes it's said, in the practice of shamatha, or calm abiding, it's like letting the discursive thinking mind come to rest and settling more and more deeply into, sometimes it's said, the storehouse consciousness. In deep, deep shamatha, stillness where thoughts are not arising and ceasing, there's just this utter stillness and rest. Some say that, technically speaking, what's happening there? It's that the kind of active consciousness has settled into the storehouse consciousness, which is defined as this still, unmoving, unknowable, inactive source of the active consciousnesses. And like thoughts, you know, arise out of the storehouse, and experiences and memories are planted back in it, but we can't actually experience the storehouse itself, except, some people say, during shamatha. And at that time, we don't experience it. Oh, this is the storehouse. Interesting. All this stuff in here. It's not like that. It's like, even though you could say there's a lot of stuff in there, but it's not active at that time. It's just in storage. It's unmoving storage. So it's just like being utterly still. And they say this is the difference between just total rest in shamatha and the vipassana, or insight into our true nature. And they make this distinction, I think, quite beautifully, because they're very similar. It's even said, this is the place of stillness, and to me it's a little disturbing that he even says clarity and brightness. Because sometimes the storehouse consciousness is described as this utterly still, but it's not clear and bright. And that's one distinction. So here it's even harder to say, because true nature is also unmoving and clear and bright. But he's saying, if you just settle into this stillness, it's the root of discriminating mind again. Just like that old fellow Korean teacher who said, sounds like you can be really settled when you let go of everything, but it's like just putting a rock on the grass. And if you come out from zazen, this disturbing grass will wreak havoc on your life again. How are you going to uproot the roots of discriminating consciousness? So he's saying, this mind of stillness and purity is the root of discriminating consciousness. Do not mistake this for true mind or true nature, and abide there. Kazan goes on, looking more carefully, mind is of three kinds: mind, thought, and consciousness. So, of course, I like this because this is one of the rare occasions of a Zen ancestor just expounding like Yogacara thought. They usually don't like to do this because it's like they want to express it in a Zen way. But this is a little exposition of the 6th, 7th, and 8th consciousness called alaya, or citta, manas, or the afflicted intellect or thought as a kind of consciousness, and vijnana, or consciousness, mental consciousness. And, you know, they're similar. Alaya, or citta itself, is the storehouse, where it's like, it's inconceivable, we can't actually experience it directly, but it's the storehouse of all delusion. So it's said that at Buddhahood, at awakening, the storehouse consciousness is overturned. Thich Nhat Hanh has a book called Transformation of the Basis. It's his translation of the basis is Elia. And it's transformed, we could say, or it's, I think more accurately, it's not that there's something there to be transformed that's already like gets us into there's some mysterious storehouse. There's nothing really there. It's just that it's a very, very subtle delusion that like an unconscious mind, and that has to be not so much transformed or made into something else. It's more just it has to be revealed what it really is. So the true nature, you could say, the true nature of the storehouse consciousness is this perfect mirror, a wisdom, non-dual awareness that no longer gives rise to delusion. And then the manas, the seventh consciousness, is sometimes my teacher would call it like the bifurcator, the one that divides the world into subject and object. It gives rise to the sense of an independent self in relation to the world. The storehouse doesn't even have that yet, but out of the storehouse arises this this view of me, and therefore you, or the environment, the self and its environment, and that division gets its own category of a consciousness of the self, called manas, and then consciousness itself is just the basic awareness of like of the sense consciousness, but also mental consciousness that is a sense of like there's a book and a room, and it's dualistic awareness of the world. That's the classic thing. So Kazan's version of that is consciousness, the sixth vijnana, is mind which likes and dislikes, affirms and denies. That's his simple definition. Thought, or this klishta manas, the afflicted with the sense of I, cognizes warm and cold and is aware of pain and itch. So maybe particularly happening to me. Mind, or Alaya in this case, the storehouse consciousness, does not discern right or wrong. It's not aware of pain and itch. It's like a wall, or like wood or stone. It can be thought of as truly still, as if it had no eyes or ears. Therefore, speaking from the vantage point of this storehouse consciousness, it's like a mannequin made of wood, or a human figure made of iron. Though you have, or another translation would be, from this vantage point, one, you could say, it is like a mannequin, the storehouse, or from the point of view of the storehouse, I am like a mannequin, or a statue made of iron. Though you have ears, you do not see. Though you have ears, you do not hear. At this point, words do not do it justice. Although such a thing is an aspect of mind, it is the seed of cognition, of warmth, coldness, and awareness of pain and itch. Thought and consciousness arise from it. So please, do not make the mistake of thinking that it is original mind or original nature. The still unmoving, non-happening storehouse consciousness, which we can settle deeply into in Zazen, don't make the mistake of thinking that this is original nature. This is quite subtle, right? Compared to Ru Jing's version of dropping off body and mind. Kazan says, learning the way is said to be apart from, or learning the way is said to be giving up mind, thought, and consciousness. It's a quote from the Fukan Zazengi. where I think in our translation we chant says, give up the operations of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. Give up all the operations of the conscious mind. This is actually the instruction of for Zazen in Dogen's treatise. But literally that give up the operations of conscious mind is in the Japanese, it says give up the operations of alaya, manas, and vijnana. These must not be thought of as body and mind. There is still a wondrous brightness that is eternally stable and unmoving. So this is Keizan's side now pointing out, well, if it's not mind, thought, or consciousness, isn't that all there is in terms of experience? He says, there is still a mysterious spiritual light or a wonderful radiance and brightness that is eternally unmoving. If you look carefully, or if you investigate carefully, you will certainly reach it. If you're able to clarify this mind, the capital M, no body and mind, with small m, can be found. No self and others can be involved. Or no self and objects are involved in this big mind. Therefore, it is said, drop off body and mind. At this point, if you look intensely, even with 1,000 eyes, there's not an atom of anything called skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. There's nothing to be divided or discriminated into mind, thought, or consciousness. How can you then be aware of warmth and cold or discern pain and itch? What is there to affirm or deny? What is there to like or dislike? Therefore, it is said, when you look, nothing is there. When Dogen personally experienced this place, he said, body and mind have dropped off. Rujing sealed or confirmed this, saying, body and mind have dropped off body and mind. Finally, Rujing said, dropping off has dropped off. Once you reach this realm, you become like a bottomless bucket, like a lacquer bowl with a hole punched in it. No matter how much leaks out, it's never empty. No matter how much is put into it, it's never full. That's a nice image. It comes up as one of those Zen phrases sometimes when somebody realizes awakening and say, the bottom of his bucket dropped out. And I think it's a nice image partly because it's almost kind of, it has a kind of semi-physical yogic feeling to it for me. We hold a lot of tension in our anus from childhood times. A lot or a little. And from kind of yogic traditions, you could say when that completely, when the base of the spine is completely open, and there's no more tension there. That's how some traditions would talk about this release. I don't know if that's what the Zen people meant, but maybe more an image of we're holding something. Sometimes it's even said, a black lacquer bucket filled with black lacquer. So you can't see anything there, but actually something's still being held. Maybe the storehouse consciousness is kind of like black lacquer. You can't see anything, but something's still there. And drop out the bucket. Drop out the bottom of the lacquer bucket. And then no matter how much leaks out, anything can flow out of there, but it's never empty. No matter how much you put in, and how much garbage you pour into this bottomless bucket now, it's never filled. nice. Yeah. Yeah. The mirror can reflect piles of garbage, and it never fills up the mirror or taints the mirror. And if you take everything out from in front of the mirror, there's still just the bright mirror with no edges or boundaries, and not coming and going. Birth and death don't hinder it. Arriving at this occasion is called the bottom falling out of the bucket. If you think, though, that there is even a hair of enlightenment, satori, or attainment, acquisition, toku, here, it is not the way. Whew. If you think, in this case, this is supreme enlightenment, I finally attained it, this is not the way. It's nothing but fooling around with the spirit. People, experience this thoroughly for yourselves. Investigate it fully, and you will find that there is a body unbound by skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Though you ultimately try to be free from this body, being free from it is not possible. Or though you ultimately try to liberate this body, liberation from this body is not possible. Might we call it the Dharma body? Though you try to abandon it or let it go, you cannot. Therefore, in speaking of this place, the ancestral teachers say, when everything is utterly emptied out or exhausted, there is something that cannot be emptied. This is Keizan style. Dogen might differ, actually. This is the ongoing debate. When everything is emptied out, there's nothing to get a hold of. But in the tradition of Buddha nature, the luminous Tathagatagarbha, when everything else is emptied, everything appearing in the world is seen to be empty. It's the word for shunyata here, ku. There is something that cannot be emptied. If you can clarify this thoroughly, you will never doubt all those venerable priests in the world or all the Buddhas of the past, present, and future. But if we don't clarify this, we might doubt this and say, I don't know, maybe Keizan's getting a little too far out here. Any questions? Comments? Nothing need be, because it's all here. Yeah? It's something to work with. Mm-hmm. And I think if we... if the monkey mind is very active in Sesshin, then first step is to settle and rest. If the self-judgment is very strong in Sesshin, hearing Keizan sometimes can arouse self-judgment. I will never get what he's talking about. This is like impossible. I can feel this way sometimes. Then first we compassion. This one is this one right now. There's only this moment. There's this person. I'm willing to be this person who does not understand Keizan's exposition. Or I kind of get the gist of where he's pointing, but this is not, doesn't sound like my zazen. this is something from some other culture, but I still feel like I don't know what to make of it. It's my lineage. First we just settle and relax. And then if we are settled and relaxed, then we can look carefully.
So it seems quite different. He seems quite lofty aspirations, whereas Dogen, like the things we chant in service, are all very, very encouraging. All you just have to do is sit. The whole world is a better place for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could also say, I mean, that noon service, right, of the self-fulfilling samadhi, you could say, in this samadhi, this is the description of what's happening. Like, the trees and the rocks and the tiles are all, like, supporting each other mutually. And it's exuberant teaching, right? And he says all of this doesn't appear within perception because it's unconstructedness and stillness, which is kind of a relief, right? Are we supposed to be seeing like the clouds dancing with the rocks and stuff? This does not appear within our dualistic perception, and this cannot be reached by a deluded mind. And I like to think of it as not like a grossly deluded mind, but just dualistic or conceptual consciousness cannot apprehend that kind of activity. Sometimes it's encouraging, and also the chant that we do before the morning talks is also I find encouraging, because it's like it's saying, by confessing and repenting our lack of faith and our doubt about these challenging teachings, this melts away the roots of our dis-ease and kind of like, this is where I'm at. That's how I hear that chant. Like, well, let's practice like Keizan's recommending. Well, if we actually have some doubt, let's just like admit, I actually doubt this. And then, miraculously, and this is where I'm at. This is where I'm at. And I'm willing to be this person. Then we settle the self on the self. And the Buddhas and ancestors in their great compassion come forward and help us, Dogen says. Yeah. Sometimes Dogen can be actually, really strict too, and sometimes he can be very affirming. In Zen it's called like the sword that can give life and take life away. And it's all about what's most appropriate in the moment.
Is it time to stop?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So I was thinking about this bucket and in cultivating the energy field. I'm sure uses that phrase is used in there, and then there's a little reference, a little footnote to it that says that it's when the bottom of the bucket drops out, it's a metaphor used for an immediate experience of total trust.
Ah, that's nice.
Yeah, and I was reflecting on this. If there's something, what or who experiences the dropping off of body and mind and dropped off is what's left. But it seems like maybe trust, maybe not as a feeling, but maybe as a vow. Or some sort of a compass, sort of.
Yeah,
something that's deep, sort of deeper than all the different mind consciousnesses.
Yeah, I think it's like a complete. I hear that as like a complete trust that my very foundation upon which I think my life is built just dropped away. And I'm willing to let it drop away. We call the self the very foundation on which our life is built. I'm willing to in a way, it is I, the self, is willing to relinquish itself and trust that this will be okay. I've heard that for over many, many millennia, Buddhas and ancestors have dropped off the very foundation of their life, and things have gone well for them. And so I'm not sure, I might be the first exception. Because I might, like, what if I stop caring about my life and everybody else? What if I, because actually it's kind of dropping off care. It's becoming carefree. So maybe I shouldn't, to protect the things I care about. But then, that's why I think I appreciate celebrating these stories, because then we hear, it looks like the care sometimes even increases, and it's more all-encompassing and impartial and vast, but it's no longer my responsibility. Maybe that's another way to look at that bottom of the bucket, the responsible one, keeping it together down there.
Do you know Jiryu from Gringo?
Yes.
Some years ago, he talked about studying in Japan.
We practiced at the same temple.
Well,
in Japan.
I didn't even know this guy, because I've always remembered the story. He talked about this teacher that he studied with, whose vow was never stray from the hara.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably him.
Yeah.
Tangen Roshi.
He go in for Dokusan, and he never made it more than like 5 minutes. The guy would be ringing the bell and kicking him out. You tell them it's not here, it's not here, which is, I think, in the Western, this is where the self is present. It's here.
Yes.
Which is kind of a self that is beyond our collective Western
yes.
self.
It's yeah.
so here, and some here. But that sensing, sort of like, is there a way to sense experience that doesn't go through that?
It's non-discursive. Yeah, yeah.
There's some teachings on that Hara guy. I don't like to hear about
him. Yeah, he spoke almost no English, but he had certain phrases in English that, because there were a lot of English speakers there, and particularly, this is very pertinent that you bring this up, because here we're talking about the equation, Lu Jing's equation with Shikan Taza and Shinjin Datsu Raku. So just wholehearted sitting and dropping off body and mind. They are one. What is dropping off body and mind? Just wholehearted sitting. What is just wholehearted sitting? Dropping off body and mind. So Tangen Harada Roshi at Bukokuji, in his instructions, it's quite specifically on Shikan Taza. In Dokusan, he would often, the Dokusan form at that temple is you go into Dokusan, you do your bows, and you present the practice that you're working on. So different people working on different koans. I was generally working on Shikan Taza. So you go in and you say from the hara, from your authentic way of, as much as you can authentically present your statement of your practice. It's a kind of a nice form, actually, to say, like, I state my practice completely, and that's basically often the only part of the Dokusan. So, Shikan Taza Nisanjit Orimasu. My practice is Shikan Taza. It's just sitting. Shikan Taza Nisanjit Orimasu. And he would say, often, some version of, Shikan Taza. Only point here. Ding 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 ding. That was one of his only English phrases. Only point here. From a point of view of, if, as long as we don't think of the hara as some like a physical thing or location, We can talk about it that way.
Energy.
But when we deeply investigate that source of energy that appears to be 3 inches below the navel, along with the Tanden and the Qigong, Qigai, this is like Taoist and Qi Gong terminology, right, that Zen uses. I would propose if we investigate that thoroughly, we find that there's still not a hair's tip of a place called the Hara. But as a practice, we bring our energy down. It's a direction down. Only point here. It's a few other English phrases you sometimes add in as like icing on the cake, like thinking unnecessary, worry unnecessary. Only point here. I remember these Dokusans and like Rohatsu were these winter months. The Dokusan room was, you know, below freezing. And so each syllable would be this cloud of like mist. Shi. Kong. Ta. Sa. With his red nose. Mm. He had big, big like eye lids. Often they'd be closed while he's speaking, and then he'd like open them. What is this principle anyway? Keizan says. Would you like to hear it in a verse? That bright and clear realm, or that clear, pure light, has neither inside nor outside. How can there be any body and mind to drop off? May the merits of our diligent practice throughout the day of Sesshin not be held on to, but offered up to all beings who don't have a chance to sit with us today, to all those who don't have a chance to even hear about the light, to all sentient beings wandering in the realms where they strongly believe that what they think is what's happening. May this merit help to relieve the discomfort and distress of all beings throughout space and time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.